You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello, and welcome to episode 44 of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal, and I am an assistant professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. In today's episode, we're going to spend some time reflecting on the September 11th attacks that happened 16 years ago today, at least as of the drop date of this podcast. We have a number of guests from varying backgrounds to help us think through what these issues mean. I will introduce each of the guests in turn and then give them a few minutes to answer some questions about what the September 11th attacks mean to the United States and to us as individual Americans.
Where were you when the world stopped turning on that September day? Were you in the yard with your wife?
Our next guest on today's episode is Ethan Reedy. Ethan has a master's in political philosophy from Catholic University and a master's in information systems technology from George Washington University, and works with technology for the Library of Congress. Ethan, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Coyle. It's good to be here.
Now, where were you and what were you doing when September 11th happened?
When September 11th happened, I was working for a think tank downtown called the Ethics and Public Policy Center. The offices of ethics were about two blocks from the White House. So on the morning of September 11th, I was actually getting ready to have one of my wisdom teeth removed. But I had gone into the office, was there, was supposed to have a wisdom tooth removed later in that day. So it makes it kind of memorable for more reasons than just September 11th.
How did your day, your routine change? Not long term after September 11th, but in the immediate aftermath. So the few days and couple of weeks following. How were things different for you?
After September 11th happened, things were kind of odd around DC generally. There are background noises that you're just used to hearing, planes flying overhead and things of that sort. And that wasn't happening, which just made the whole city feel quieter than it usually did, except for the fighter jets that would come overhead on regular intervals for several days afterwards. So it just had a very different feel. I know my wife was walking with our kids in one of the neighborhood parks, and she was stopped by a reporter from the Washington Post, I think, who was just wandering around and doing interviews with people, asking them why on earth they would think about living, and particularly living with a family, in Washington, D.C., when things like this might happen. For a while, there was a very different feel to life in the city.
In President Bush's first press conference after the attacks, he said,
"Freedom itself was attacked this morning by a faceless coward, and freedom will be defended."
How should we think about this statement or the attacks in general? As citizens of a Western liberal democracy, as Christians, is there a difference between those two categories of thought? Take those sort of in any order you want to take them.
I'm not sure. I was thinking about this after you talked to me about doing this podcast, and I'm not sure I can think about the attacks very differently as a Christian than I would hope that people would as members of a liberal democracy. Terrorism in general, there might be some more complicated questions in terms of political theory, but the issue with September 11th is that it was essentially an attack by a state actor. It was, yes, obviously decentralized and not quite the same way that we think about it, but the Taliban was in control, and it was in significant part because the Taliban was in control of Afghanistan that they were able to put these attacks together and make this happen. So I'm not sure that I would fully agree with President Bush's statement. I'm not sure that it's really quite freedom as a whole that was attacked. I don't think that is really what the Taliban was thinking, but you know, it made a good statement. So I'm not going to argue with it too much. But I do think that, you know, when a state actor like that attacks you, and it certainly was a clear attack, I think there is a call for justice that is not only reasonable, but is the responsibility of the government of a liberal democracy to protect its citizens. And so there was a response that was required, I think, on our part. And so and in that governmental sense, I think that's what we did is what needed to happen. Now, you know, you could argue in terms of whether we needed to have the full all-out attack that we did, or whether we just needed to try to exact some sort of retribution, I suppose you could say. But in the end, I think that the response that the Bush administration put together was reasonable and appropriate, and was the same whether you were a Christian or any other member of the liberal democracy. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, certainly. So if we're one of the questions I've asked everyone else is, you know, if we're thinking Islam versus Western liberal democracy, whose side should Christians take? You sort of come down on the side of Western liberal democracy.
Well, yes.
With the understanding that there are, you know, it's not really, it's sort of a loaded question, right? Because Islam is complicated and there's a right. lot of different, I sort of intentionally ask that provocatively to get the pushback.
Yeah, and I think you have to understand that, the Islamic understanding of the state is fundamentally does not go along with a Christian concept of the state. You can't have that sort of freedom of religion and freedom of expression, things of that sort that a Christian would expect of government within the Islamic political mindset.
Right. Which of course raises questions about how Christians should be interacting with the Islamic states, which are not supporters of terrorism, which are our allies, but which have fundamentally different base values. And I'm not an expert in Islamic states, but yeah, it does sort of move in good directions in terms of what sorts of questions we should be asking, I think.
Oh, no. I think you're right. But of course, from the perspective of a Christian American, the question would be not just how do we interact with those states, but what is our role nationally in terms of the way in which we care about the political structures of other states. So there may be situations where it is perfectly appropriate to have an ally who acts in a way that we think is inappropriate in some ways internally, but nevertheless is an ally.
Right. And of course, from the perspective of the other state, we're in that same situation, right? We are an ally that acts in many ways incredibly inappropriately, given our sort of modern American culture, and comparing that to, say, traditional Islamic morality or something along those lines. So there's some give and take, I guess, on each side there.
True.
And again, maybe we're getting more into Islamic politics than either of us are really comfortable with. It's certainly not my area of expertise.
It is certainly not my area of expertise either. So,
a couple of questions to close this out, because we're interviewing so many people, we don't want our episode to be 2 hours long, as they have tended to be lately. Sorry, listeners. So my students, my freshman students this year, when September 11th happened, were 2 years old. What do you think these students most need to know? How do we tell the next generation about this event? What do we need to pass on to them?
Wow. I think they need to, first of all, it sounds strange, but they need to be able to, as best as possible, attempt to experience what happened. And that it's sort of the same sort of thing that I would have said about my own generation. You know, I grew up after Vietnam. I have no memory of what happened in Vietnam, very little experience with what it would feel like to, you know, have your countrymen come under attack. And so just the shock of what happened that day, and to recognize what it felt like to come under attack. I mean, we didn't talk about this earlier, but you know, I think one of the most interesting things about that day to me was just being in DC when this happened and the complete uncertainty about what was going on. You know, we were hearing news coming in. I heard absolutely confirmed news that a bomb had gone off right outside of the State Department. It was first circulating as sort of, you know, innuendo, and then people were coming onto news stations saying, yes, this is confirmed. There was a bomb that went off in front of the State Department. And then there were people on the news saying that there were, you know, there was smoke coming from the White House. They thought for sure that the old executive office building was on fire. And of course, this was all just people who were standing at the wrong angle and seeing the fire from the Pentagon and misinterpreting it. But on that day, there was just such chaos. And I was, you know, working downtown, I ended up walking home that day because no one trusted any form of public transportation. There was fear that there was going to be something. At that point, we didn't realize it was just the planes. We thought there were bombs that had been placed other places. And so people were not getting on the metro. And so I walked home with literally probably thousands of other people walking across downtown DC, heading to their homes miles away because they, you know, didn't feel safe utilizing any other form of transportation. And so, you know, just having that experience and then, you know, the same sorts of experiences that happened in New York City, you know, those are all stories that need to be told just so that people can get a feel for what it would have been like to, you know, be a part of an area that where people felt like they were actively under attack. I think the story of Flight 93 is a story that needs to be told and retold, just because it's, you know, the sort of real morality tale that can help, you know, particularly young men understand what it means to sometimes be a person who will stand up for what is right, no matter what the cost is. That's one of the stories that I think needs to be told over and over. So, yeah, I think that would be, you know, primarily the concern. I think, you know, the generation that you're talking about, which is my own children's generation, they're freshmen in college this year. I have two sons who are freshmen. But they're going to have to really struggle even more in some ways than we have with thinking through what it means to live in a pluralistic world where there are Islamic nations that have a different political philosophy than we do. They're going to have to think through that, I think. And, you know, our response was just a large, significant military response. They're going to have to think through what it means to live together. And I think that's going to be the harder thing to do.
Right. And I suppose it could be an advantage or a disadvantage, and time will have to tell on this since they won't know what it was like before.
Right.
So they won't have that sort of retroactive perspective on this event changed things. They live entirely on the other side of the event. And again, that could be a good thing if we are indeed safer, and if all of the things that we have done at home and abroad have made us safer, then living on the other side of that means you haven't really lost anything because you don't remember that, you know, flying used to be fun, that you used to be able to get on an airline, you know, 20 minutes before it took off and
right.
So on. But the disadvantage, of course, is you know, it takes 2 hours to fly. And I'll try not to go on a rant about TSA. That's been a consistent challenge through all of these interviews, is me not going on a rant about TSA.
Yeah, no, but I mean, it's a legitimate, you know, question in some ways, just for Americans politically, thinking through, you know, how do we allow terrorism to impact us. I mean, I was thinking about it because we went down to the Labor Day concert on the Capitol lawn, which used to be a fun thing to do. And you could just walk down onto the Capitol lawn and sit there and hear the National Symphony Orchestra, you know, play a lovely concert. Now it involves walking a whole lot further and standing in long lines to get through Capitol Police security. And, you know, I lost my pocket knife this year, for goodness sake. So it just, especially in D.C., it impacts, you know, all facets of day-to-day life. And I'm not sure to what extent it actually is. It makes us safer. It certainly makes life more complicated.
Right. Yeah, I'm one of the, I suppose my generation is one of the last that actually got to visit DC and do some of the stuff, before the security was the way it is now. So I remember visiting in high school, and going to the Capitol building, and, I think there might've been metal detectors, but I mean, if they were there, they were pretty unobtrusive, and it was, I don't even, honestly, I don't even remember. I don't remember the security, yeah. From the late 90s. And I don't think it's just because I was a stupid teenager. I think it's because it wasn't that common.
It was.
Now we're on the other side of that.
You could walk into any door in the Capitol building. There were metal detectors, but yeah.
Right. Anything to add, anything else to throw in there?
I don't think so, but thanks.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Ethan, for coming on the show. We appreciate having you here.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot for having me, Coyle.
Where were you when the world stopped turning on that September day? Were you in the yard?
Our next guest is Dr. Paul Miller. Dr. Miller has joined us in the past to talk about his book, American Power and Liberal Order, A Conservative Internationalist Grand Strategy. Dr. Miller works at the Clements Center for National Security in Austin, Texas, where he lives with his wife, Jenilee, and their three kids. He attends City Life Church in Austin. Dr. Miller, how are you doing?
You know, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on the show again. I really enjoy it.
Yeah, we've gotten great feedback, and you know, you're good for ratings. We'll have you on as often as you want to come on. I guess the requisite first question when we're talking about September 11th is, where were you and what were you doing on that particular Tuesday?
Yeah, so 16 years ago, on September 11th, 2001, I was in the United States Army. I was at Fort Huachuca, Arizona. I had just finished my master's degree, and I was in my second summer of Army training down at Fort Huachuca, training as an intelligence analyst, the Army's intel school there. And being on the West Coast, you know, we were 3 hours off of East Coast time. And we were on an odd training schedule, but in the middle of class, someone, you know, came in and told us that there was something going on in New York. And as we kind of finished class in a sort of mid-morning and filed outside, they told us there's something really big going on in New York. And they canceled class for the rest of the day. They marched us back to the barracks, and we walked in to the TV room just in time to see the towers fall. On live TV. And we spent much of the rest of the day kind of watching the live coverage of it. And they didn't know what to do with us because we were on a military base. We didn't know how large the attack was going to be. Military bases around the country went on lockdown. And we were just trainees. There wasn't much you could do. But they were wondering if they needed to post guards and security all around the fort or not. So it was a frightening day.
And maybe this isn't a question that you can answer 16 years after the fact, but was there a noticeable difference in kind of your life as a soldier immediately post September 11th than before September 11th? So I know long term, of course, there are differences, but the following week, following month, and so on.
Well, yes, I think immediately all of us understood that we were probably going to be a part of whatever response was going to come. In the immediate aftermath of 9/11. There's kind of widespread speculation about, where this came from, how we're going to respond. We're going to war. Where are we going to go to war? But we all felt sure that we were going to be a part of the response. And I have to say, while we were angry and we were frightened, at the same time, we were also, I was very proud to be where I was. I was proud that I was there in the Army so that I could be part of the response. It felt like the right place to be. And I carried that with me, and I indeed was mobilized to active duty shortly after graduating from the Intel course and spent the following summer in Afghanistan. And that's still one of the professional achievements I'm most proud of, is that I got to be there and I got to contribute in the early days of the war.
So on the day, on September 11th, in his press briefing, President Bush said,
"Freedom itself was attacked this morning by a faceless coward, and freedom will be defended."
How are we supposed to think about the events of September 11th from the perspective of a Western-style liberal democracy, and as Christians, and are those the same thing? And you can take those sort of in any order you want.
Yeah. So President Bush, his quote there is, I think, broadly accurate at the level of political rhetoric. You know, if I was a historian writing it, I'd say Al-Qaeda attacked the United States as the symbol and preeminent power of the liberal order. And that might be a more historically accurate way to say it. But President Bush is speaking to hundreds of millions of people. He's trying to offer a simple explanation for what happened. And it's roughly true. You know, Al-Qaeda and the sort of jihadist movement they represented and tried to lead was attacking, for them, the symbol of what they hated, the symbol of the sort of, in their eyes, the secular, pagan, infidel, degenerate West, right? And that was why they chose the targets they did. And it was very potent for them to do so. It was a powerful sort of recruiting tool for them to do that for their followers.
So we had some discussions, I remember, in class. So I was a freshman in college when this happened, about whether this was an attack on our political system or an attack on our economic system. And I remember someone pointing out that obviously the targets were intentionally picked, but in picking targets in New York, they did pick the World Trade Center rather than the Statue of Liberty, which I assume to some extent was logistical, you know, larger target versus a smaller one. But I'd be interested to hear your response, you know, sort of our economic capitalist system as the real target, as opposed to our political values, or is that just a nonsense freshman discussion, as, you know, no doubt many of our discussions when we were freshmen were.
Yeah, I think that the target, I think you're giving them a bit more credit for detailed strategic thinking, or maybe tactical thinking. My sense is that the targets were picked more for their symbolic value as symbols of the world order which they wanted to fight and attack. No, I don't think that they were deliberately withholding an attack on our political system and attacking capitalism versus democracy. In fact, that we have since discovered, in, you know, some years ago, unearthed an archive of Al-Qaeda documents, that the fourth plane, the one that went down in Pennsylvania, it was heading for Washington, D.C. We all knew that. It was heading for the United States Capitol building. So they were intending to attack symbols of American democracy as well as the symbols of American capitalism up in New York.
Right. Well, how should we think about the attack then, again, from the perspective of citizens of a liberal democracy and then as Christians?
Yeah. Well, you know, President Bush presented our response. He framed the attack as an act of war, not a criminal act. Right. Up until that point, we dealt with terrorism as a crime. And he decided to respond to it as an act of war. And I think that was mostly the correct decision. I say mostly. I think there's a few tweaks I'd like to see in law. I think that maybe he missed an opportunity to introduce a new category in law to treat it as an act of terrorism, which is something between crime and war. But, you know, I'm kind of splitting hairs a decade and a half afterwards. So I think it's accurate to say that this was an act of war. And as an act of war, the United States has a right to respond, to defend itself, from future attacks, and by the way, to help the rest of the world defend itself as well. The United States is not the only target that Al-Qaeda and other jihadists have attacked. Similar groups, Al-Qaeda itself and its other groups, have attacked. You know, they attacked London in 2005 and Madrid in 2006 or 2007, Bali in Indonesia a couple of years later, Casablanca, Riyadh, and of course, most of the people who have died from this sort of violence are Muslims in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Somalia, Libya, Yemen, elsewhere. So, what I'm saying is, our response is a justified response of self-defense on our part and collective self-defense on the part of kind of the whole world. Rewind the clock a little bit. Think about just war thinking by Christian theologians over the centuries. They long argued that, you know, of course we always have a right to self-defense, but in addition, just war thinkers recognize a certain category of enemy who commit, they would say, crimes against nature. They always put piracy and human sacrifice in those categories. I'm confident that the same theologians today would put terrorists in the same category. These are enemies of civilization. They're not just enemies of the United States. They're enemies of every country. And so responding to this violence, this act of war, is entirely justified by the United States, and it's a justified act of collective self-defense as well. And again, I say that as an American and as a Christian. In this particular case, I don't see a tension between the two. There are occasions when those two identities are at odds, but in this case, I don't think so.
Yeah, and at some point, we'll have to have you back on. So I think I agree with pretty much everything you said there. Now that would maybe lead into the question of whether the actual practical responses fit the criteria of what you're talking about. In Afghanistan and Iraq,
yeah.
Particularly the just war criteria, things get a little slippery when you're attacked by a non-state actor, right?
Yeah.
What does it mean to attack a nation when you are attacked by not a nation?
Yeah. So, you know, and that's actually the specific question I went and looked for. I'm trying to write a book on just war. So maybe you'll have me back on the show when I finish that book.
And sure.
Yeah. That's actually not a new phenomenon. Again, the just war theorists 500 years ago, they wrote specifically about piracy and about human sacrifice, about what they called crimes against nature, and about other so-called enemies of civilization, non-state actors, pirates. So again, it's not a new issue. And they were very clear saying, yes, sovereign nations have a duty, not just a right, but a duty to respond, to defend themselves and defend all of civilization when these enemies of civilization attack. So I don't think the non-state aspect complicates things very much. The United States' particular response in Afghanistan, I think, was fairly straightforward. And again, I was part of this. I don't think there was a whole lot of debate at the time, 16 years ago, about the justice of that war. Iraq is a very different matter. It did not start out part of the war against al-Qaeda. It became part of the war when al-Qaeda also invaded Iraq in late 2003. And so it became a proxy battle between the United States and what became al-Qaeda in Iraq. So that's very complicated, messy. But Afghanistan, I think, it was always fairly straightforward. And to me, it remains straightforward today. Al-Qaeda is still there. The Taliban is still there. The Taliban has never denounced al-Qaeda. The Taliban has never severed ties with al-Qaeda. The Taliban has never taken us up on our offer to reconcile with them so long as they sever ties with al-Qaeda. So I think that our fight there against the Taliban and al-Qaeda is still straightforwardly just and unproblematic.
Right. I'm sort of in the process of shifting some of my thinking on that. Not because I necessarily disagree with anything that you've just said, particularly the Taliban al-Qaeda connections, clear. My hesitation is increasingly based on our ability to respond properly to that. If nothing else, as evidenced by the fact that 16 years later, they're still there.
Yeah.
But again, that's maybe a conversation for a different podcast. Go ahead.
Yeah,
I guess I opened it. Go for it.
Yeah. If you, I'll try to give a 30-second response there. And I get what you're saying that a just war has to have a reasonable chance of success, and I think maybe it's true that I'll say it for myself. I overestimated America's capabilities and competence, earlier in my life. Wait for my book on Afghanistan to come out because I think, you know, the fact that we haven't won yet doesn't mean we can't have won by now. History is not inevitable. It wasn't predetermined to turn out this way. And I'll argue as long as you like about the missed opportunities that we could have taken advantage of and the mistakes that we made along the way. We could have done differently. We could have won this war earlier. And we still can achieve an acceptable outcome. Not the optimal outcomes that were once out there, but we in Afghanistan can still achieve an acceptable outcome. I maintain that hope.
Right. Shifting now over to the theological side of things.
Sure.
Is this... is this war between Islam and the West something that, that Christians ought to pick a side in? And if so, what ought to drive our thinking there?
Yeah. So I'd first very strongly disagree with your characterization that there is a war between Islam and the West. That's what...
Good. That's yeah. That's the right answer. Yeah.
Okay. Perhaps that was a trick question there. That's what the jihadists want us to believe. But in reality, the war is mostly between jihadists and the rest of Islam. And we are a peripheral actor that got attacked on the way, and so we're involved in this, and we're trying the best we can to support and train and help the actors in the Islamic world who agree with us and don't want to kill us. That's kind of what our involvement is all about. So we as Christians should hope for peace. We should hope for justice. And we as Christians and as Americans should seek to find partners across the world, including in the Islamic world, who have no interest in living under the reign of the totalitarian jihadist thugs. And that's a very realistic and achievable thing.
Sure. And when I am at my most mercenary as a Christian, I do think that there is now at least Afghanistan, one nation that is open to missionaries in a way that it has never been prior to this, or at least not often been prior to this.
Yeah.
Which is not a good, American foreign policy goal per se, but as a Christian, it's an opportunity that's somewhat unique.
Yeah, but that's absolutely true. And that's a part of the justice and peace and flourishing that we want to see happen at the end of all war. Going back again to just war, the goal of war is peace. And if and when we achieve peace, that also usually opens up greater openness, greater freedom, and that means also greater religious freedom. These things go together, and that should be kind of part of what we aim for when we go to war.
Well, I'm at the point now, and I'm sure you're here too, where I have students who, when September 11th happened, were 2 years old. What do you think they need to know about that event?
I actually show my students video clips. I have a clip compilation on YouTube, and I show them the live news coverage, because they've seen the still images and they know the basic facts of history, but they have not had the visceral experience of seeing the shock, hearing the anger, and seeing the sorrow. And so that's what I show them. I show them those live clips so that they can kind of live through seeing it happen. And it hits them at a different level. And that's kind of what I want them to come away with. I fear that if we lose that visceral sense, we then lose the urgency of our response, of our proper response. It's almost as if Pearl Harbor happened, to use a historical analogy, it's almost as if Pearl Harbor happened, but World War II never ended. You kind of want people to remember Pearl Harbor, to remember why we're still fighting. So we want people to remember at a visceral level about 9/11 so that we understand why it's still important for us to be involved around the world, helping train and equip our allies to fight the jihadists who are doing this kind of death and mayhem everywhere.
Right. Well, anything else you want to say about the subject? There's much we could say, but we have several speakers lined up, so we don't want a 20-hour-long podcast. maybe we do. So we could talk about things like security and privacy at home and airline travel and so on. Anything you want people to know or think about in conclusion here?
Yeah, I mean, to bring it maybe back to the war in Afghanistan, I want people to know that and I still believe, and I'm not the only one that believes that the war in Afghanistan is in fact still just, it is still important, and it is still winnable. And by winnable I mean we can achieve an acceptable outcome there. Yes, we've made mistakes everywhere. We've made mistakes in Afghanistan and Iraq, and the issue you raised about privacy and security at home, we've made mistakes there too. But the presence of mistakes does not invalidate the legitimacy of the animating original cause. The original cause is still important. And in fact, if we give up on that cause, we're apt to make even more mistakes in the future. I think winning or achieving an acceptable, honorable outcome is actually really important for kind of redeeming those mistakes and helping us learn the right lessons for the future. So I very much believe we need to be cognizant of all that and be aware of what's at stake in this fight.
So let me ask you to maybe talk a little bit more about that. Do you think that the war in Afghanistan is winnable by Americans, given our current culture and understanding of the world and character.
Yeah.
Current culture, character, and understanding of the world.
Yeah, I mean, I keep trying to hedge my language and say achieve an acceptable outcome. Because right now, we actually don't have that many Americans in Afghanistan anymore. We used to have 100,000, and now we're down to about 10. It might be up to 12,000 American troops in Afghanistan. So that's a 90% reduction. So the answer, of course, is no. We've never been on track for us to win it by ourselves, and that's not the goal. The goal is to help the Afghans win the war against other Afghans and against Al Qaeda.
Right, right. Sorry, let me rephrase that. The question isn't do we have the material means to do it. It's do we have the sort of temperament and creativity and worldview that can win that kind of war?
Yeah, that's a tricky question because the answer can become a very self-fulfilling prophecy. Because if I say no, then that actually becomes part of the problem. If I say no, you know, we lack the will, we lack the understanding, we lack the appreciation for justice. I mean, that kind of perpetuates itself. It breeds discouragement and it can actually contribute to the lessening of our political will. So I want to shy away from that. And I want to believe that, you know, leadership really does matter. When a statesman stands up and says, hey, look, this is important, this is just, and we should try to work for this, it can actually help persuade people. And one thing that, you know, to get a little bit political here, one thing I would fault President Obama for is that although he made some right policy choices in Afghanistan, sending more troops there and more money, he really, I think, failed as a wartime leader in that he failed to explain why it was important, why we were still there, and why we needed to stay dedicated to the cause. He just never made that case. President Trump, I have almost nothing good to say about President Trump, but he gave a speech on Afghanistan a few weeks ago that I thought was actually quite good because he said, this is important and we're going to win. And those are two things that President Obama never said. So I think President Trump did a good thing in that speech. And that's all I'll say about that.
Well, fair enough. Well, Dr. Miller, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah.
I look forward to your next book coming out and to having you on again.
All right. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Where were you when the world stopped turning? That September day, were you in the yard with your wife?
Our next guest on the podcast is Dr. Kwesi Afore-Yeboah. Dr. Kwesi Afore-Yeboah is an expert in international relations and comparative politics and serves as professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. As you can tell, he is my senior colleague. Thank you, Dr. Afore-Yeboah, for traveling all this way to be on the show.
Thank you.
Dr. Afore-Yeboah was educated at Queen's University in Toronto. Is that correct?
Kingston, Ontario.
Kingston, Ontario. Man, I don't know my Canadian geography. Educated at Queen's University in Canada and the University of Ghana. He currently lives in Bolivar, Missouri with his wife and four kids and attends Southern Hills Baptist Church. Dr. Afore-Yeboah, the question we've asked our previous guest is that on September 11th, 2001, President George W. Bush said,
freedom itself was attacked this morning by a faceless coward, and freedom will be defended.
I'm interested to hear your thoughts on that, particularly as someone who did not grow up in the United States, was not educated in the United States. Before we get to that, just to give you a little chance to think of it, where were you on September 11th and what were you doing when the plane set?
Right. I was on my way to campus, and then I heard the first, at least news of the first strike, I mean, when the first tower was hit. So I was on my way, I heard it over the radio, and then when I got to campus, there was news of the second crash, and that's when the news, everything was haywire in terms of what was really going on. So in my class, we were scrambling, trying to make sense of what was happening. But I was on my way to school and to class to teach.
And so obviously there are long-term differences in our nation after September 11th, but how were your days different and weeks different in the immediate aftermath? What changed in your daily schedule, in your life, and so on?
Nothing personally other than professionally trying to make sense of what was going on, because then as a student of international relations, as more details emerged as to the origins of the perpetrators of the attack, it became obvious that this wasn't just a domestic issue, but it had international ramifications. And so my professional life got more interesting, if I can put it that way, just in quest for answers to what happened on that day.
Now, in terms of answering that, was freedom itself attacked? What's your sort of response to that initial statement by President Bush?
It was, in a sense, that they took advantage of basically the free movement of people in this country, and in hindsight, the ability to get a training that they did to fly the planes. And so taking advantage of our freedoms, they abused it, or they used it for evil. So in that context, they misapplied our freedom, but freedom in a context of what is guaranteed by the Constitution in and of itself wasn't under attack, but it was the abuse and misuse of it, which at least caused the nation to pause and rethink some of the things, or rethink how we did some things.
Sure. Yeah. So how should we think about this event as citizens of a Western-style liberal democracy? How should we think about this as Christians? And is there a difference between those two answers, or is it just the same answer? You can take those in any order you want.
Well, I think there's a difference. I mean, as a nation, once again, harking back to the Constitution, we have certain basic freedoms that any time a nation is under threat, we kind of have that balance between security and liberty. In other words, there's always the pendulum swinging in one direction or the other, especially when we come under attack. So in the wake of 9/11, as some may recall, Congress passed a bill which basically gave the intelligence agencies more leeway in trying to harness or gather information. And some saw that as an overreach in terms of government.
And this is the Patriot Act.
Right, Patriot Act, exactly.
And then the Freedom Act down the road.
The Freedom Act, exactly. So basically, those were taken in response clearly to 9/11. So as far as liberal democracy is concerned, you're always trying to find a balance or walk the fine line between ensuring that people enjoy all the freedoms that are guaranteed, but still within the law, as it were, or without abusing it to hurt people. From the Christian perspective, though, it's just a reminder that evil is still out there, and that people, because remember, these acts were committed in the name of, it was a religious act, or committed by people who profess the faith. And so that should give us pause as Christians to say, okay, how do we resolve these issues? And how can we as Christians, really? It's just a reminder that the world is evil. We have work to do. And basically to promote, at least to be good students of the Great Commission in terms of turning people to Christ. Because once again, the hatred and everything else is born out of evil. And the only antidote to evil is Christ. And that may sound like cliche, but from the Christian perspective, I'm saying Christ is the answer.
So in the war of Islam against Western democracy, which side should the Christian take?
Without a doubt, Western democracy, because with Sharia and everything else, I mean, Christians should know better that religious intolerance from the medieval times, everything just leads to bloodshed and doesn't promote the promulgation of the gospel in any way. So despite the flaws one may find with Western democracy, religious freedom allows Christians to exercise their faith and also to spread the word. Whereas even though you could be a Christian in Saudi Arabia, you are prevented from proselytizing. You can't. And I'm saying that is being mild. So the extreme form, if ISIS were to have its way, clearly I'm saying, I mean, there would be no Christianity.
Right, and that's, so your use of Sharia in comparison of ISIS there is probably the good distinction to make, right? It's not really Islam versus democracy. It's a kind of Islam, an interpretation of Islam, standing against other Muslims and the Western world in general. In terms of the American responses to September 11th, do you have thoughts on that as a political scientist, as an international professor? We have lots of international students, but international professor.
Well, we had no choice. In other words, Osama bin Laden was running free in Afghanistan. There had to be a response, I mean, to prevent further attacks, because obviously they had a grander agenda, and literally to bring America to its knees if they could. So we had no choice but to respond. And so we are in Afghanistan right now because of 9/11. Our immigration laws, at least, are being revamped under President Trump. I'm saying going back to 9/11, his ban, at least his attempt to limit entry to certain countries. I'm saying you can connect that to 9/11. So we had to respond. And it's one of those issues of there's no silver bullet, as it were, to deal with an unwieldy enemy, unlike a nation state where you know the target, you know the principal actors. In this case, we know the principal actors, but there's no territory per se. There are shadowy figures. So it's just a new territory in terms of the enemy out there. And so American response, I'm saying, has to evolve and adapt. And it's still an ongoing quest to root out this threat, as it were.
Now, it's been 16 years as of the drop date of this podcast. Do you think Americans can evolve and adapt, given the events of the last 16 years and given sort of where you see our culture now? Is that something you're optimistic about? Or
I definitely am, because we're making progress. We are in the sense that, and of course, we don't know what all else is going on out there, but at least the homeland hasn't experienced anything of the scale and magnitude of 9/11. I mean, we've had sporadic, the Orlando incident, the one in San Bernardino.
Right, and they're mostly domestic. Right. They're not internationals.
Right, exactly. So I'm saying kudos to the intelligence agencies and all the people out there trying to keep us safe. But I'm saying at least we haven't had another 9/11 or anything close to it. So in that sense, something can be said for at least the progress that has been made. And internationally, I mean, Osama bin Laden has been eliminated. Al-Qaeda is not as potent, or at least we are not seeing them. Of course, they may have been usurped by ISIS, but even ISIS, as we speak right now, is on the run. And so I'm saying there is progress being made, and there's a gleam of hope that we can adapt and confront this challenge.
Now, in saying that we haven't had another domestic attack, are you voicing your support of and like for the TSA?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't like when I have to take off my shoes and everything, but it's a new reality, and so it's a new normal, and after all these years, I think we've adapted and adjusted accordingly, even though Missouri is still holding back against the driver's license.
Yeah, that's what the news tells us every week. For those of you who don't live in Missouri, every couple of months there's an article in the newspaper about how our driver's licenses will very shortly no longer be valid for travel. Every time that comes out, I call the airport and ask if that's true, and every time they say no. Every time they're like, "Yeah, your driver's license is fine," but the ongoing discussion is are our state driver's licenses secure enough in the way you get one that they can be trusted for international travel. We, of course, in Missouri, we have the unique advantage of we're right in the middle of the country, so anyone who wants to get a false driver's license has to get here first. Right. Anyway, that's a sort of a federalism issue that's ongoing, maybe blown up in the news a little bit, but it's still an interesting one that we go through in class. So we both teach at the same school. We have students who, when September 11th happened, were 2 years old. What do you think they need to know?
Well, to make sense of American foreign policy today, for instance, they need to know why we're in Afghanistan. And that has to go back to 9/11. They need to know why we're in Iraq. That goes back to 9/11. They need to know why President Trump, for instance, proposed. In other words, if they are students of history, when they go to the Patriot Act and the Freedom Act, they need to know all these were in response to 9/11. And even to the issue that you just brought up, or at least we just discussed, the Missouri driver's license, prior to 9/11, it was a federal issue. Every state decided when and how to issue driver's license. But in the wake of 9/11, the federal government wanted to standardize the issuance to ensure that there's communication across states, so that it's not the perpetrator. So I'm saying they need to know, and TSA, I mean, some of the restrictions. Some of the restrictions there. So their life really has been changed by 9/11. Sure. And so if they have to join the, I mean, God forbid, but if the draft were ever to become an issue because of ongoing unrest in other parts of the world linked to Al-Qaeda, ISIS, 9/11, all I'm saying is they may not feel it, but 9/11 changed certain things in America, and it impacts them.
Right. Do you think we have an obligation to teach them what America was like before it? Because they don't know in America pre-9/11. They don't know that flying can actually be a fun experience rather than grueling. Do we have some kind of obligation to point to that as maybe not a better way? I think it was a better way, but at least a different way, or is it just this is the reality now? And
no, they need to know, because then to appreciate or to make sense of why we do things the way we do, it would help if you can compare it to the pre 9/11 and then post 9/11 America, because you'd see in some sense two different Americas, and it helps to be able to compare those two Americas, because then you're able to put things in context and in better perspective. So they need to know, because otherwise some of the things we do right now wouldn't make sense to them. I mean, they may go with the flow, but they may know any better.
Right.
And history, at least, will then, if they know it, I'm saying, to help even as they grow in life, to if anything were to happen, at least they have something to go off on in terms of what to do. So they clearly need to know.
And I guess one last question. Again, back in the early 2000s, President Bush talked about a coalition of the willing standing against the axis of evil. Where are we with that today? Or is it still the same players working?
Right. So when it comes to Afghanistan, we still have NATO and then the coalition of the willing, and so there's still,
which was not part of the axis of evil though. Afghanistan wasn't.
Right. No. So yeah. I mean, remember the Afghanistan, the Axis of Evil speech was given in response to 9/11. But at the time, I mean, Afghanistan was ground zero. I mean, right. The only reason why we didn't add Afghanistan was because in the war against terrorism, I mean, these countries had a record. So the Axis of Evil countries, I'm saying, had a long record dating back decades, literally. I'm talking about Iran. They are called the state-sponsored terrorists.
Right, so it's North Korea, Iraq, and Iran.
Right. So I'm saying they had a track record. Afghanistan had more of an internal, but they're not seen as sponsors of international terrorism as the Axis of Evil. So maybe that's why they were excluded. But the point still remains that with Afghanistan, we had a coalition of the willing, as it were. We had Canada and some of these, kind of the UK. Of course, with Iraq, we didn't.
Right.
And so the coalition is still, I mean, and Afghanistan is still a NATO mission, US-led NATO mission. So with Afghanistan, I'm saying the coalition still is holding, albeit in a very weak form, as it were. And then, of course, with Iraq, it's still, we are more or less on our own. And so, yeah, we didn't have it, and I'm saying we don't have it in Iraq. We had it in Afghanistan, but with the passage of time and the changing dynamics there, it's not as strong as initially when we got started.
Sure. Well, anything to add on September 11th or related issues?
No.
Well, thank you, Dr. Afuera Yeboah, for coming on the show, and thank you for your insights on September 11th.
Thanks for having me.
Where were you when the world stopped turning on that September day? You in the yard with your wife.
Our next guest on the show, our last guest on the show, is John. John is a male who works in national security on the East Coast, and I think that's probably all I'm allowed to tell you. John, is that right? Is there anything else I can give them?
Yeah, that's fine. Thanks.
You can lift 300 pounds straight up over your head. Is that true?
Oh, at least maybe 5. Yeah,
okay. Excellent. Well, then there you go. There's 3 facts. That should be enough for any of our listeners.
And I leap tall buildings in a single bound.
Hey, there. Well, that's maybe a little too specific. Now they're going to know who you are. I guess the first question, where were you? What were you doing on September 11th? So where were you and what were you doing on September 11th?
I was in Washington, D.C. I was downtown. I was in an office building on the 5th floor of an office building, a 5-story building, about 3 blocks from the U.S. Capitol. And several of my colleagues began streaming into one of the offices that had a television, and we were watching as the first plane had hit the Trade Center tower. And just looking sort of awestruck and all telling each other this was not an accident. The second plane hit. I might get the sequencing a little bit wrong, but at one point the newscaster came on and said, "We've just heard that the Pentagon had been hit." And all of us knew that, you know, from our windows we could basically see the Pentagon. I craned my neck around to look out the window. No one else did, which is interesting. It's like nobody wanted to look. And I craned my head around and looked out the window across the river and could see smoke pouring out of the Pentagon. Then informed my colleagues, and a couple of us went up on the roof and watched as the Pentagon was just, you know, billowing in smoke across the river. And then looked over and saw that the Capitol was only 3 blocks away and immediately ran inside and figured out what we needed to do, because we thought that the Capitol might also be a target.
Which, in retrospect, of course, we know that it was a target.
Right.
How did your days change in the immediate aftermath? So not you know, long term, but you know the days and couple of weeks after. Were your routines any different? Did your day look different at all?
Well, it was different in a number of ways. I think for starters, as the hours began to unfold, I was sort of holed up in my building. My wife was also downtown and trying to evacuate, and just got stuck in traffic because there were so many cars also trying to get out of the city. And she called me and said, "John, I think Leslie and Charles were on that plane." And I said, "What?" She said, "Yeah, I think that was their plane." And Leslie and Charles were friends of ours from our town, and they and their 2 children, they were university teachers, and they were heading off on sabbatical. And sure enough, that in fact was Flight 72. I think it was 72 that hit the Pentagon, and they were on it. So that was quite jarring. I mean, not only had buildings been struck in New York and Washington, but we actually were sort of impacted. You know, we knew these people. They were our children played together. That sort of colored everything from there. It really brought it home. Afterwards, you know, it was all a little bit surreal, because we suddenly realized that the United States is not protected in the way we always have been traditionally. You know, the oceans and friendly neighbors to the north and south in the Western Hemisphere have protected the United States historically. You know, the British had to sail their rickety wood boats all the way over here to attack us. But in this day and age, attacks can occur. They can occur here in North America, of course, with attacks. They don't even have to fly planes here. But, you know, this sense that we're protected here in North America was really shaken. And I think, you know, it shook all of us, that this is striking very close to home, that many of the violent maladies that afflict other nations we are not immune to them.
Yeah, and that's I think a good point to step into the broader conversation. So President Bush, in his press conference after the attacks, said,
"Freedom itself was attacked this morning by a faceless coward, and freedom will be defended."
How how are we supposed to think about the events of September 11th from the perspective of a citizens of a Western style liberal democracy, and how are we supposed to think about it as Christians? And you can take these in any order you want. Respond to the quote first, hit the questions first. Just sort of take it and run with it.
Yeah. So Bush is. I mean, Bush. That was a very, very political statement with the intent of rallying America behind Bush's agenda. So September 11th did not begin the war on terrorism, really. That this is something that we have been engaged in for, you know, probably two decades before. September 11th just brought it to the homeland. But, you know, we had known about Osama bin Laden for, you know, since the early 90s and had been tracking him, had been trying to hit him. You'll recall, you know, Bill Clinton launching a cruise missile into Afghanistan and missing him. But not really taking it very seriously, again, because we sort of thought that the U.S. homeland was more or less protected from anything but smaller attacks. There was the 1993 attack on the Trade Center that failed to bring the building down. That was a van they drove in. But when you say freedom is attacked, you really, you know, that's really kind of getting at this American psyche that we're sort of the representative of freedom in the world. You know, we represent freedom. And this is a value Americans hold very, very highly. It goes all the way back to the Revolution, where, you know, we sought freedom from, you know, the oppressive British regime. So it's really meant to trigger that piece in the American psyche that rallies the troops and says, you know, we've got to band together and fight. And Bush's speeches starting very, very soon after September 11th. I'm not sure what the date of that speech was, but
that was September 11th. Two,
that was on September 11th.
That was
right?
Yeah, that was that afternoon.
That afternoon, and within a week, he was making more speeches and was talking about a war on terror. You know, so this now is so there's, you know, this is loaded with meaning because war is something that a president can undertake of his own volition, of his own executive power, but is you know, really something that Congress is supposed to act on. You know, Congress is supposed to say we're at war. So when Bush says we're now engaging in a war on terror, this also has a lot of meaning. It says I'm going to use the full force of the military strength of this nation. And we're not going to really recognize the kinds of rights that you might otherwise be afforded. This now is war, so we're just going to go out and kill you. And so this, you know, this gets in. This is sort of the precursor to the Bush doctrine of preemption, which was very controversial. I personally agreed with it, but it was very controversial that we would hunt down, identify people that we determined to be terroristic threats against the country and just kill them rather than attempt to bring them to justice through the traditional justice system, whether that be, you know, the Hague or here in the United States in our federal courts. So, you know, this is a major shift now. September 11th brings on a completely different approach to terrorism. But when Bush says, so freedom, I don't like that particular statement that freedom itself is under attack, because we're not really the world's representative of freedom. And, you know, maybe democracy, but I mean, democracy isn't our invention either. So, you know, we're champions of democracy. We're champions of human rights. We're not the only ones in the world who are champions of freedom, democracy, and human rights. In fact, there are some who would say we're not even doing the best job at it. But freedom is really kind of an illusion. So I sort of react to that. Freedom is always freedom from what, right? Freedom to and freedom from. And, you know, the Bible says that we're slaves of sin and there's freedom in Christ. Jesus said that he would free us. And that's really the only true freedom. And yet even there, Paul says, I'm a slave of Christ. So, you know, I suppose we're only truly, truly free when we have died and gone to heaven, and there is no sinful world in which we live. Then you're really free. But short of that, freedom in Christ on this earth is freedom from the tyranny of sin. And I'll take Jesus as my master any day over any kind of either earthly lord or sin that might try to be my master. So when Bush talks about freedom, it's obviously political freedom he's talking about, and that political freedom is really kind of an illusion. The only real freedom is in Christ.
Well, I don't know that Bush would necessarily disagree with that statement, although presumably he meant something
he
more
wouldn't.
To the...
I mean, he claimed to be a Christian, and I think he was, right? But the statement was political.
Well, right, so he means something more to the effect of, I can criticize the government and not be thrown in jail for it. And as far as that goes, that's not an illusion, right? I mean, I do it all the time and don't go to jail for it. That kind of freedom, I assume, is what he meant was under attack.
Yeah.
And I suppose, well, I don't want to get too much into the nuts and bolts of policy. We could argue about whether or not that is an illusion today, but at least in 2001, you could still pretty much say what you wanted about the government without fear of much in the way of reprisal. But maybe we should ask what are we supposed to think?
I think Bush's statement went way beyond just freedom of speech to, you know, the whole political system.
Sure.
And is our political system more free than that of, you know, an Islamic, you know, Sharia law system? Absolutely. So I don't disagree with it on a relative scale. But, you know, if you really want to pick at it, you can find a lot of ways in which we're not free. But, you know, in a democratic capitalistic society, you know, my rights are my freedoms, if you will, are curtailed in a number of ways. It becomes an academic argument. I'll get that.
Sure. Well, how should we think about these events then, both as American citizens and as Christians?
Well, so I think there's a tendency to think about terrorism generally as almost an anomaly among all of the evil things that can happen in the world. And I tend to not see them that way myself. Terrorism, you know, we sort of see terrorism as something that shouldn't happen. It shouldn't be this way. We shouldn't be attacked randomly, civilians, you know, innocent people, quote-unquote innocent people, being attacked by unnamed, unknown religious zealots from desert countries in the Middle East. It's almost bizarre, I think, to a lot of people. And so it's less and less surreal, but I think in the early days after 9/11, you know, people were saying, why are they attacking us? Why are they attacking us? People didn't understand. And our understanding of that has deepened a lot as scholars have dug into the radical Islamic mindset and what their goals and mission is. You know, we're starting to get it. But, you know, I see 9/11 or any kind of terrorism as just a symptom of a fallen world generally. So, I mean, again, this is my personal opinion, and people will differ on this. And you could have lengthy debates about it, but just personally, and I work in terrorism. I mean, counterterrorism is sort of my profession. But I see terrorism as just one of countless maladies in a fallen world. And, you know, right now there's a hurricane sweeping up Florida, and people are going to die, and tremendous physical damage is going to be done, you know, $10, $15 billion, great suffering as people's homes are destroyed, and they've lost their pets, and they maybe have lost a loved one in this storm. So, you know, these are the results of a fallen world. The fact that people who are, you know, deeply sinful and I would say evil are doing this, in a sense, if you look at it from, these are just the maladies of a fallen world, then in a way they're kind of the same. You know, we walk on this earth for a short period of time. If you're lucky, you reach the 100-year mark, otherwise 70 or 50 or 30, and people get cancer and people die in drive-by shootings. And, you know, whether it's coming from the evil heart of man or whether it's natural, in a sense, you know, God calls people home. He strikes people down. And that's the nature of a fallen world. I think the evil in the world is meant to call us to the cross. It's meant to bring us to the cross because that's the only place where we find comfort and the only place where we find salvation. And the only, it's the only thing that makes sense in a fallen world. Hurricanes don't really make sense. Terrorism doesn't really make sense. I mean, evil doesn't make sense. But I think there's a purpose to evil, and that's to drive people to the cross.
Well, I certainly won't disagree with that. So I've got students now that when September 11th happened were 2 years old. What do they need to know about September 11th? What do we who were old enough to realize what was going on need to pass on to the next generation?
Yeah, so I think there's a general consensus in the counterterrorism international relations communities now that we are now engaged in an ongoing battle of civilizations and ideologies that will last for generations. So I think, you know, and my son was 4 when this happened, and my wife and I debated letting him see the images on TV, and we decided that he should. So he's growing up in a world where terrorism is reality. My generation, we have been struck a little, you know, somewhat jarringly by, oh my goodness, what's going on? But I think the general consensus now, and I certainly ascribe to it, is that you simply cannot, you know, so Bush's war on terrorism, let's go back to that. I think Bush really believed that he could squelch and crush terrorist networks and organizations, keep them from having any kind of haven or homeland, and basically, if not completely crush it, then effectively contain it. And that's been pretty much demonstrated to be not true. I think Syria, the rise of ISIS, and the use of cyber technology, communications technology to spread the ideology, to inspire people in any corner of the earth to commit acts of terrorism, basically randomly, and thinking that they're getting some, you know, praise from Allah when they go to meet their maker, is reality now. And the ideology has not been squelched. It has grown and continues to grow. And ISIS will probably be denied a permanent homeland because I think that ultimately ISIS will be beaten in its current form. So they're not going to have territory that they can call their own and create a caliphate. That's what I mean by that. But the nature of the beast is the more you kill and fight, the more justification they have for what they do. And their message rings in the minds of people that they impact that are like-minded. So, you know, moderate Muslims become radicalized because they begin to believe that the West is just simply out to crush Islam, which it isn't. But they believe that, and then they say, "I have to fight for Islam." So this now is going to go on not for another 20 years, but 100 years or 200 years, and it's entirely plausible that at some point a caliphate, for lack of a better term, will emerge, and we won't be able to stop it without just, you know, nuking it or going in and just carpet bombing and all of the collateral damage. And we're not really willing to do that, the Western powers. So, I mean, if you think about it, there already is, you have the state of Iran, which is a theocracy. It's as close as, it's basically a Shia caliphate under their own religious law. The Sunnis want one. The Sunnis want a broad caliphate, and they will fight the Shia. So, you know, we should expect not only terrorism against the West, but we should expect war between Sunni and Shia, and that could be a massive bloody war.
Right. And that's a question that I've
Iran
asked.
Iran is a pretty powerful nation.
Yeah, that's
sorry,
something. No, that's something I've asked some of our other panelists. Is, you know, in the war between Western liberal democracy and Islam, which side should Christians take? And basically, they've all been quick to point out, yeah, it's not that simple. Right, Islam is a very complicated thing, and even within it, there are divisions and sides. And in some ways, this is a battle between Muslim and Muslim that we have been sort of caught up in.
To some extent, yes, but we've been caught up in it. But you know, the genesis of you know, this whole Sunni movement that Bin Laden really became the champion for, and people have followed in his footsteps. Is they want their own land, they want to govern themselves, and they don't want Western influence. So Bin Laden's battle was to push Western influence out of Muslim nations and to depose the corrupt Muslim governments, for example, the Saudi regime, to depose them, because he saw them as corrupt, and they are. He saw them as worldly. You know, they go and pray at Mecca, and then they fly off to Paris and have massive drunken parties and prostitutes. And, you know, he's like, you guys, you're just corrupt. You're religiously corrupt. You're ethically, you know, the whole nine yards. So that's what they've been trying to do, is purge their own countries of corrupt leadership and establish what they see as righteous government. Under Sharia law. And I think, you know, as Americans, going back to the whole freedom and Americans being champions of democracy and human rights and freedom, that's what they fight against. Islam is much more than a religion. You have to understand this. Islam is a religion, but it's much, much more than that. It is a religion. It is a governmental structure, and it is an economic structure. So those three things make up Islam. So if you're really a true Muslim, you need to live in a Muslim country under Muslim governance.
Now go ahead.
That creates a bit of a question for people who claim to be Muslims and they're living in Western nations, because they're seen as apostate by you know, what we would call the radical Muslims, who believe you should all live under Sharia law and that everyone should obey Allah. So the President of the United States, the Congress, all of our local governments, all of them should obey Allah and Sharia law. They see that as the only, and they're willing to do it at the point of a sword, you know, and this was Muhammad's way. I mean, Muhammad conquered. Islam means submit. You know, it's you will submit. So this is the governance aspect. You can't live your own life in a Muslim country. You will live under Islamic law, and you will do things as they say. And if they say you can't drink alcohol, you can't drink alcohol. If they say you have to wear certain garments, you have to wear certain garments. We say that's oppression, but they say that's freedom.
Well, the big points you made earlier about how they want their own state free from foreign influence under their own law, is there anything that you know we would necessarily object to as Americans about those three statements?
Well, I think what we would object to is, we would look at those laws and say they are not right. according to our value system. So we are imposing our value system on Muslim countries. We're saying that they should have freedom of speech. We're saying that they should have, you know, the same constitutional freedoms to assemble, for example. That they should be able to choose the religion of their choice or no religion, you know, pluralistic. We think that they should be able to own property in the same ways that we do. All of these, we think we have the right system. They think they have the right system. I think from a Christian standpoint, I would say ours is much closer to, you know, to a Christian standpoint where, you know, Jesus didn't impose on anyone. He called people to repent and believe. Whereas Muhammad said, you will believe, you will obey, or I'll kill you. So there you have the difference, Jesus and Muhammad. Jesus lived in a pluralistic society. He lived in a land that was Jewish and worshipped Yahweh, but was occupied by heathens. And there were gods all over the place that were not Yahweh. Jesus didn't go after them. You notice he wasn't trying to develop some uprising against the Roman occupation. He said, repent and believe. He didn't go into their temples and smash their idols. He said, repent and believe. He went into the Jewish temple and drove out the money changers. But Jesus' message was, repent and believe and come to the one true God, and that's where you will find true freedom, freedom from the tyranny of sin. So our Western system, which is so heavily influenced by Christianity and Judaism, is much closer to what would be the ultimate form of governance, which really is a benevolent dictator. If you think about it, you know, when Jesus reigns, he's the benevolent leader. He's not going to have a Congress under him. He's essentially a benevolent dictator. But it's a rule of love, not oppression. So, you know, the Muslim form of government and rule is oppressive. It's wrong. Their concept of God is wrong. Their concept of how one is saved is wrong. They know people need to be saved. They just got it wrong. You know, it's an evil God it's an oppressive God that they serve.
Right, which I don't just necessarily disagree with that theologically. My hesitation there is whether or not that's the political reason that we might, you know, be engaged in combat with terrorism.
You know, the political reason is really complicated too, because Americans on the one hand want to reach out to oppressed peoples and see them freed, and you know, we have this natural human desire to see everyone happy and healthy, you know, whether that's children starving in Africa or people oppressed under Muslim regimes. That's human nature. We think we have it good here, and we do, you know, and we have tremendous freedoms and prosperity in this country, and we'd like to see that for everybody. It's sad to us to see other people around the world who are oppressed and suffering. We also want to make money. You know, the American model is let's do business. We don't invade countries and conquer them. We want to do business. We want influence around the world so that our businesses thrive. That's capitalism. So a lot of what we have done in the Middle East is to facilitate business. You know, whether it's buying and selling oil or whatever, we want to do business. We want to make money, and we would like the world to be this open marketplace where people can compete and prosper. You know, because they've worked hard and they were clever, and that's contrary to the Muslim model.
Well, anything else to add on any of these topics? Otherwise, we'll let you go and get back to staying out of the hurricane's way. If that's the part of the country you're in, anyway.
Yeah, we're fleeing South Carolina. No, I guess it's hard business, you know. It's hard business, but there's been war as long as there have been people on the planet. I think we need to expect war. We need to expect these clashes of ideology, clashes, should I say, of ideology, and we're in this for the long term. I mean, there's a dedicated core that will continue to grow, I believe, to continue to grow and become more powerful. The American model against this may become one more of containment. We may be forced one day to accept a Muslim caliphate and just say, well, you know, there's nothing we can really do about it because we're not willing to really engage in a massive bloody war to stop people from having the kind of governance structure that they seem to be choosing. And then we have to figure out how do we deal with a Muslim caliphate in the Middle East and, you know, protect our ally Israel, who's under grave threat from this. So, you know, these are tough times, whether you're a Christian or not, these are difficult times. I think for a Christian, you know, we look at the bigger scope of things and we look at the end times, we look at the prophecies of Revelation, and we say, are they getting near? Are the wars and rumors of wars and whatnot, as the prophecies have talked about, are they coming upon us now? Christians need to be ready. We need to pray. We need to pray for our government, that our government is wise and just in all of its dealings internationally.
Sure. All right, well, John, thank you so much for coming on the show. You guys stay safe, stay dry, and hopefully we'll get to talk to you again sometime.
Thanks, hope so. You're welcome to edit out everything I've said.
Yeah, well, I won't be doing that. I'm just hoping I don't have, you know, black helicopters hovering over my house by the time this posts live. So,
no, probably not.
All right, well, thanks so much, John.
Thank you, Coyle.
Where were you when the world stopped turning? That September day, were you in the yard with your wife?
And once again, thank you to all of our guests for coming on the show, and thank you, listeners, for listening in. For more information about our show or any of the shows on the network, please visit ChristianHumanist.org. If you haven't left us a review, please go ahead and rate us on iTunes. That's the best way to help people find our show. You can check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast, where we occasionally post extra articles and have longer discussions in written form. You can contact us there or contact us directly at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. On behalf of Ed Song, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.